Welcome to What's Wrong with Wolfie. My name is Jason.
And I'm Rich.
And I'm Chris.
And we've reached the video games of 1996. Some people would say that we've entered the golden years of video games, and I can see their point. With the arrival of PlayStation, the market really was turned on its head, and with the Ultra 64 on the horizon, promising 64-bit gaming from its cartridges, it really was an exciting time for gamers around the world. But the 16-bit era was also a golden year for video games too, and the games from the Mega Drive and the SNES definitely hold up better today than some of their 32/64-bit counterparts, mostly thanks to some janky cameras. A part of me is sad to be leaving them behind, but in 1996, seeing the likes of Duke Nukem, Resident Evil, Crash Bandicoot, Tekken 3, and of course the Pokemon games, it was the early steps. I don't know why I mentioned Pokemon games, it's not really 32-bit.
No, it's not at all. I don't think Nintendo ever played with 32-bit, did they? Ever?
No, I don't think they did they?
Skipped to Gen and yeah, the rest is history.
Well, you know, Pokemon games came out in 1996 and they were, you know, quite popular. But it was the early steps into the games that we appreciate and play to this day. On this week's show, our picks are Tomb Raider, Wipeout 2097 and Quake. We delve into the UK multi-format chart and see what exactly we were all buying. And let's just do that right now, shall we? Guys, I've got the weekly charts up for video game, the multi-format video game charts in front of me for the whole of 1996. I need some help choosing which one we look at. So, Rich, can you just choose a number between 1 and 52?
Jeez, 51.
51. Awesome. Cheers, buddy.
I'm doing this shit again. So,
and we're off.
Okay, so we're going to look at week 51 of 1996. So we're right at the end of the year. I've got the top 10 in front of me, and number 10 for the Mega Drive, the Game Gear, the SNES, and the NES. Published by Virgin. What do you think it is?
Aladdin? No, it can't be Aladdin. No, it might be Aladdin. Aladdin, I don't know.
No, it was Lion King.
Oh, yeah, sorry, yeah. Of course, I came a little bit later.
Yeah, the Lion King was number 10. At number 9, it was for the SNES and the Game Boy, it was Killer Instinct. Never played Killer Instinct on the Game Boy. I imagine it was probably pretty shit, to be fair.
But yeah, I think I've only ever played Killer Instinct at all on the Xbox. It's pretty decent. It's all right.
I've never played it.
Yeah, good music. Some banging tunes, actually. So,
I'm also a Killer Instinct virgin. I've never really played it. So maybe I feel like that's another gaming franchise I need to get going, because it's quite a popular. Well, I mean, we haven't had a new Killer Instinct in quite some time, have we?
Well, I think there's literally like three games. There's like Killer Instinct. There's like Killer Instinct Gold on N64, and then there was like whatever the one is that came on Xbox, which I think was just called Killer Instinct.
Maybe not as popular as I thought then.
They're fun. There's better fighting games out there. I wouldn't.
Yeah, you know. I guess so. There is quite a challenging market, shall we say, in beat 'em ups, isn't there? So.
But yeah, your Clay Fighters and all that, Rise of the Robots.
Yeah. Rise of the Robots, come on.
Dog shit.
Okay, number 8 for the Mega Drive, the SNES and the Game Boy. A nice film tie-in, it's Toy Story. Moving on. Number 7 is Tetris for the Game Boy. Still banging that into the charts at number 7.
Jesus.
In 1996. This must be like 7 years after the release, isn't it?
The GTA 5 of its time.
Yeah.
Cockroach, seriously, it just doesn't go.
To a point where I don't think they're even bothered with a GTA 6 at the moment.
Well, apparently it's in development, so we'll wait and see, shall we?
It has been for about 5 years now, hasn't it?
Probably longer. Probably longer, mate. They probably started it when 5 came out. You know, but but I'd love to sit here and chat GTA 6, but we've got 1996 to talk about. So at number 6, talking about 6, all the sixes. For the Game Boy as well, it's Dr. Mario. Got enough to say about that. Although I played the Dr. Mario game on the phone that came out last year, and I'm really shit at it, so I think that's probably why I don't like it.
It's just a phone mechanic, so they make it so you're shit at it, so you buy fucking microtransactions and shit like that.
Yeah.
Pay to win. Crap.
Yeah, hate it. Number five, it was Premier Manager 97 for the Mega Drive.
Nice.
I never touched Premier Manager. I was very much more of a Championship Manager on the PC kind of gamer.
Fucking football game. Jesus Christ.
What was that, Chris?
He's saying something disparaging about football.
Football games.
Oh, okay.
Football management games, Chris. So it's an entirely different class of football game. Just like
they're the same picture.
I don't know. I think one of my friends back in the day, he was not a footballer. He didn't like football at all.
Beaver is rich, but he's addicted to football games. Yeah,
exactly.
I don't know why.
When it came to Championship Manager, he was all in on it. He loved it. Played it for hours upon end. There's just something about those games that just hook you in and just want to make you play for hours.
The idea of management games always really intrigues me, but I know I'm just always going to be terrible at them. I'm just terrible at organising, coordinating, all that crap. Because I know there's a new F1 Manager game coming out this year, and I'm going to get it. And I know I'm going to play it for like half an hour and never touch it ever again. Can't wait. £50 well spent, Rich. Good job.
So. Yeah, I know where you're coming from. Like, Championship Manager, I was pretty shit. I could never really get a team together that flowed well enough to do anything, really. Apart from one time, and I decided to be manager of Real Madrid. And funny enough, did pretty well. So,
fair play.
Yeah. But I think I managed to be a manager for like 15 seasons. And I was getting to a point now where the players that I had when I started with being their own managers. And I was beginning to have a team of players that were complete, you know, I didn't know the names were non-recognizable. But I was out to try and do the, I mean, I think there's like it stops at like 30 seasons or something. Then it automatically retires you or something like that. And I was out to try and get to that point, but I've got Championship Manager fatigue.
I'm surprised after 15 years. Jesus.
Number four in the charts was another Game Boy game, and that was Mario and Yoshi. I don't know anything about that. Do you guys?
I assume that's the one.
That's the Collins one, isn't it? Mario and Yoshi games, because I had
it that. Might be. My first thought was the one with like little baby Mario, but I'm thinking of like Yoshi's
Island
or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I think Chris is right. It's the puzzle one.
It was one of the only Mario games I had on the Game Boy. It's Mario and Yoshi, and it is just columns.
Oh, okay.
You gotta switch them round and then match them up.
A bit like Dr. Mario, and a bit like Tetris then.
Yeah.
And just like the same games that are still taking the world by storm 30 years later.
No, you can't beat a winning formula.
No.
Speaking about winning formulas, number three was Sonic 3D. For the Mega Drive.
Well, it was a nice attempt, you know. And it kind of looks nice in screenshots, but then when you see it moving, it's just, ugh.
Yeah.
Makes you feel sick.
I mean, for what they managed to get out of the Mega Drive, I mean, this is not even like a 32X. Title. This was just a plain Mega Drive, and to show you exactly what they could really get out of the Mega Drive, it was quite impressive actually. And like you say, where it moved, I mean, it was janky and it wasn't that great, but it was still quite an achievement.
Still, just don't understand what Sega were playing at. Why was that on the Mega Drive? And you were supporting Mega CD. You had Saturn out that year, and I'm just like
32X. They're the Nomad.
No wonder, who'd have thought Sega would just piss away all that goodwill? I can't figure out how that would have happened. How?
Ah,
crazy. I don't know.
Lost to the times, mate. Lost to the times. Number two was Donkey Kong Country 3 for the Super Nintendo.
I've been a Donkey Kong fan.
I love Donkey Kong Country games. They were brilliant. So I think I was probably all in on this one.
Donkey Kong is never, I've never really played it.
I think like with the Donkey Kong Country games, like for our age group, seeing these new visioned Donkey Kong platform games was just, and like the way that they managed to, same bit like with Sonic 3D, where they managed to get these kind of graphics out of an aging technology, and it was really impressive.
Actually, like kind of scanned in like physical assets, weren't they? They're actually almost like kind of stop motion kind of. That's what it looked like to me. They actually put them as in, you know, put assets in the game instead of just making the sprite. It was actually textured and reflections on it, and it just looked it looked nuts.
Yeah, and you know the platform, you know, it was Rare games as well, so it was really showing what was to come from Rare as well when we get into the N64 days. And it was just great platforming as well, and bringing in the new characters as well, especially with Donkey Kong Country 3, with I think they brought in Dixie Kong with 3 as well, with her, she could like twirl her ponytail so she could like glide across gaps and stuff, so you could get to further places that were further out of reach and stuff like that. It was just really good, enjoyable platforming. So always recommend a Donkey Kong Country game, especially like the Game Boy ones as well. It still amazes me how they managed to get those games working on the Game Boy too.
I've got one of them down on the shelf there, but I can't remember which one. It was yellow cartridge.
Yeah, that'd be the first one then, Donkey Kong Land.
Yeah, probably.
And number one, so this is the weekend in the 21st of December of 1996, the number one game for the Mega Drive, the SNES, and the Game Boy, apparently. Published by Electronic Arts and THQ International.
THQ.
Where is it, boys?
Has to be FIFA, surely.
FIFA Soccer, 1997.
Things never change.
Some things never change.
No COD. That's about the only thing that's different.
Yeah, give it a few years, mate. Give it a few years.
So is THQ involved? I never realised THQ were affiliated with FIFA.
It must be the Game Boy version.
Okay.
Must be. Good. Electronic Arts concentrating their efforts on the Game Boy port.
No.
So there you go. That's the top 10 for 1996. Nothing that exciting, really, was there? Nothing really going on. The PlayStation games really hadn't affected the chart yet, had it? And
which is weird, actually, you think about it. That's had about, a couple of months to, you know, make its mark. So I'm actually quite surprised, actually. Wow.
I got a feeling 1997 is going to be a little different.
Yes.
Maybe not the number one game, though.
Well, it would be different. It'd just be a different year.
Yeah. FIFA Soccer 98.
Title was completely different.
Yeah. Okay. So, yeah, that's the chance for 1996. Let's move over to the games that we've chosen for this year. And like I mentioned at the beginning of the show, that being Tomb Raider, Wipeout, and Quake. Rich, let's come to you first.
Mm-hmm.
Which one of these games did you choose?
Yes, mine was Wipeout 2097. Going into getting the PlayStation that year for Christmas, it was never the game that kind of jumped out to me at the time. I was like, all about your Crash Bandicoots, your Tomb Raiders. They were the ones I was really like amped up for. But something about this game grabbed me, and I asked for it for Christmas, got it, and that kind of began my love affair with like anti-grav futuristic racing games. It's a very specific subgenre racing game that even to this day I seek them out and I look out for, you know, all of them, whether they're good or bad. I enjoy them, whether it's Extreme G, F-Zero, Fast RMX, all those ones. What all jumped out to me with Wipeout 2097 was, obviously, again, this was going into PlayStation. It was like really a real sea change in terms of what gaming was seen as being and how it felt. And we had like grown up games during like 16-bit era, things like, you know, violence, you know, Robocop versus Terminator, Mortal Kombat. But I think with Wipeout, what felt grown up about it and what felt so refreshing was that it felt more kind of grown up in a sophisticated sense.
Yeah,
it had the design, the logos, the music, just the whole like Clubland kind of appeal going on. It felt like a grown up game that wasn't about blood and, you know,
didn't they do like a whole tour of nightclubs for this game?
Yeah, and they even did. They gave out like leaflets as well, flyers for the game, but I think the flyers were actually kind of somewhat perforated so people could use them to roll them up to
really
other things with them other than just read them, which I thought was genius. Like, they went to Ministry of Sound, everything. They went to like Cream nightclubs, all that stuff. And it was just, again, I was at the time, I was 15, pushing 16. So I was probably still skewing that slightly young, you know, right on the entry to that kind of, you know, thing, but I appreciated it for what it was. It wasn't the gaming you were growing up with. This was just such a refreshing way of looking at games. And I'm sitting in my bed on Christmas Day and I'm playing, you know, racing in my Pfizer hover ship, and I've got Prodigy Firestarter playing on my TV, and I'm just like, this is not like anything I've played before. A few Christmases prior to this, I was running around doing, you know, the Marble Zone with Sonic.
Yeah.
And now it just was so different. I mean, I got really wrapped up in the hype for this game as well. I think it was like the month before they released the Fluke CD single, Atom Bomb.
Mm-hmm.
I even picked up that CD and I listened to it all the time. And knowing that some of the music was in the game, and I was just like, at that point, I was never really brought up in PC gaming. It was all cartridges for me. So hearing all this music, thinking, this is going to be in a game that I'm going to get like a couple of months from now, I was just so hyped. It was just something so different, and just, it felt like next generation to me. Like, it just, everything about it, again, the visual stylings, even the fonts. I mean, I do enjoy a bit of dabbling with like graphic design and fonts now these days, and I feel like that kind of owed to Wipeout at the time. Mm-hmm. I've always loved all the Designers Republic stuff, all that material went into the game. But yeah, it's like the total package for me. I mean, I enjoy the racing, and I love the soundtracks. I just love the whole vibe of it, the whole aesthetic. It's one of my favorite gaming series of all time, and this was obviously the beginning for me. I never played Wipeout from the previous year, the one that came out on like the Saturn and I think even the Atari.
I think, like you say, you mentioned about the soundtrack, and I think this was probably first time that we had like a real life music song track in a video game. You know, it was incredible to have song that I had a CD single of sitting on the shelf with Firestarter, and here it was in a video game, and I'm doing this futuristic racing with it playing, and it was, like you say, it was mind bending. It was just crazy, bizarre, even just from that alone, let alone everything else that you said about Wipeout, and it was just such a turn in video gaming, and it was just crazy.
I think because, obviously you think about Prodigy, you had like Chemical Brothers as well. It was all that stuff at the time that was so in the charts. But I think from an actual audio design standpoint as well, like original music had all the cold storage stuff in it, all the original music that was done for the game. Mm. And some of that is like some of my favorite gaming music of all time. And I do kind of still seek out some cold storage stuff on like Spotify even today.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, yeah. I don't want to make it sound like I'm just hyping Wipeout because of the soundtrack.
No,
it obviously was a critical part.
Exactly. You nailed it on the head. I mean, the soundtrack is one of the most pivotal moments of the game. It's a very important part of our memories of Wipeout and how it made us feel playing the game. The soundtrack is very important to the game. So, yeah, it's definitely worth waxing on about because of that.
I think what really jumped out about it, because I mean, there was plenty of other games I loved on the PlayStation early on, but I think Wipeout was the one that like sold it. That was like the mission statement. That was like that was almost kind of like the PlayStation and Sony's, hey, we're here, we're changing shit up. This is different. You know, this isn't your granddad's gaming. That was the game that was like the flagship for me. That was like, oh yeah, okay, that was where I was really drawn to the PlayStation.
Mm.
Yeah, it's one of the things, it is hard to describe. It's no real one tangible thing. It's just so many little ingredients in that series. Even today, I mean, I've played like Wipeout 3, Pure Fury. I played all of them. I love them today. But you can't beat the original. I know there was Wipeout previous year or year before that, but 2097 for me is still like, you know, the daddy of them all. Long, you know, summing it up, to me, the Wipeout is the PlayStation. PlayStation is Wipeout. That's what I think of in that first year, which is like a pivotal year in gaming.
Mm.
So, yeah, I've got so many fun memories of that game.
Chris, you're pretty quiet. Have you got any memories of Wipeout?
I've never played them.
I like how you take a swig of your drink as you say that, because is that like a celebratory toast because you've never played it?
No, I know of the games. I've seen them played on YouTube, but I've never actually owned a copy, or none of my friends either. I don't ever remember them playing it. I've known of its existence, but I've just never, cliche, I've just never gotten around to it. And then 20-odd years later, sort of sitting there going, I've never played one.
I mean, I'd be lying if I said there weren't futuristic races I do actually prefer. Like, I still think Extreme G3, Extreme G Racing Association, F-Zero GX, actually quite a lot of futuristic racing games are actually better to Wipeout. But I think Wipeout was the one that still sticks in my mind, because that was the one that kind of laid the groundwork, in some ways.
You wouldn't have any of those games without Wipeout.
Yeah.
And also, like, yeah, again, talking a little bit about the soundtrack, I think it really showed other developers what you could do with the soundtrack.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And really inspired them to do the same with their own games.
Yeah.
Like, but you know, further on in the future from 1996, obviously they got better with the PlayStation 2 and the Dreamcast, putting in their own songs, you know, like Sonic Adventure 2 and Escape from the City and those kind of tunes, and even to Gran Turismo. You know, Gran Turismo had tons of like well known brand songs.
Yeah.
And when you think about Gran Turismo, that's what you think of straight away. It does to me anyway. I automatically think of the soundtrack.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, God, even what a couple of years on from 2097, you actually had Wipeout 64, and they actually went above and beyond and squeezed like two Fluke songs and a Propellerhead song. I think it's Propellerhead's bang on.
Mm-hmm.
They put those three songs on an N64 cartridge, heavily compressed with loading times on the cartridge, but it was worth it.
Yeah.
And weren't just like 10-second, they weren't like 10-second clips just looped like you'd get with like, you know, some of the N64 licensed music. They went out of their way. And I feel like it really influenced a lot of developers, like with music and specifically the futuristic racing genre as well. Because even like Extreme G, you had that on the year, I think it's the same year on N64, and it was kind of like generic, kind of very primitive techno songs. And then like you got to like Extreme G3 on the PlayStation 2, and you had like Ministry of Sound in there. All these futuristic games, they all followed the Wipeout template. Almost to a fault. It was close to ripping off, but yeah.
So even owning an N64, I still never had that game. I even got given a load of games from a neighbour. Like when they got rid of their 64, I think I got given like 10 random games that they just didn't want anymore.
Please say you had F-Zero X though, because that was like the N64's Wipeout, really. Even though it was actually Wipeout in N64.
I might have done. It's just really random that those games had literally never crossed my paths. It's so funny, isn't it? Like,
yeah.
You think by now, somehow. I mean, more than likely, I'll probably go into Loft tomorrow and like open my N64 storage crate and I'm like, what the fuck is that? It's like a copy of the game. And I'm like, But no, I've definitely not played any Wipeout games, which is a crime. I understand that. But
I was going to say, I mean, is it something that interests you? Is that a kind of genre of game that you're into?
I love racing games.
You got PS4, haven't you, Chris?
I do still have a PlayStation 4.
So you can get the Wipeout Omega Collection. It's really good. A little compilation of the PS3 and PSP games, I think, like HD Remix.
Really good.
It's a good game.
Still can't believe I've never played it.
Yeah, you can get it dead cheap. CX, that shit. Get it for a few quid.
Fiver. So, done.
Yeah. Just make sure you've got your black light on you, you'll be fine. So.
Just always reminds me of that classic Family Guy gag when they put a black light in the hotel room. There's nothing there until the light goes on and there's a goat on the bed. Dead hooker in the shower. It's just like, what the fuck? Oh, when Family Guy was good.
Oh, man.
I'll definitely give Wipeout a shot.
Ooh.
I haven't even been playing the Switch much, to be honest. Just haven't had the time.
Well, Electronic Gaming Monthly editors awarded Wipeout 2097 Best Music of 1996 and a runner-up behind Super Mario 64 for Best Graphics. In 97, the official PlayStation magazine named it the fifth top PlayStation game yet, and Electronic Gaming Monthly named the PlayStation version the 96th best game of all time, calling it the first game of the cyberpunk-esque electronic age before the electronic age was just a hype-filled buzzword. In IGN's top 25 PlayStation games of all time list, it ranked 13th, noted for being often considered the PlayStation's best racing game of its time and was chosen ahead of others in the series because Wipeout 2097 was the one they preferred to keep coming back to. In 2003, Wipeout 2097 was inducted into GameSpot's list of the greatest games of all time. It ranks as the third best PlayStation game at Game Rankings. Jeez. With an average what the fuck was that? An average review score of 94.75% from 10 different sources. Good pick, dude.
Yeah.
Good pick. So, before we go to Chris's pick, which is his turn next, we have been having quite a fun time recording this podcast this time around. I think whatever can go wrong has gone wrong, whether it's people needing to update laptops or people's connections go in or hardly hear people or whatever. I mean, even I disappeared at one point as well. So we do apologize. This podcast sounds a little bitty because I've had to hack it to death.
Not bitty now, bitty later.
Sorry, Kelvin.
Sorry, oh, no.
He left the door wide open there. Sorry, mate. No,
I'm good at that. So we are... we are trying, but technology seems to be against us for this one. But
oh my god, man!
Have we recovered?
Yeah, I think so. I hope so.
Another mention, though, never say bitty ever again.
It's just the fact that we both sniped at the same time for the same gag. Oh.
Oh my god. Continue.
Okay.
That needs to stay in the edit. I'm sure. Brilliant.
It will stay, mate. It will stay. Don't you?
And relax.
Moving on to Chris's pick. Which one of these games did you choose as your game for 96?
I chose Tomb Raider. I was a PC gamer at the time, so we didn't have a PlayStation at this point, didn't have an N64, I think we had a Mega Drive, and I think I had a SNES, was about it. No, I didn't have the SNES, sorry, that was later on. But yeah, we had a PC that was given to us by my uncle, so I was into PC gaming and sort of borrowed a lot of friends' games and stuff. And I was introduced to Tomb Raider, through a friend from school. And I'd never sort of played anything like that, because when we were growing up, we just didn't have the games. We had a PC, but only games that we could afford or got given by friends, family. But Tomb Raider comes along, and I'm just completely floored by not only the 3D environment, but the interactivity. Yes, it's clunky now when you look back on it. The turns, the jumps, you've got to press the certain jumps in a certain sequence, so she jumps off the end, otherwise she falls. It's all clunky now, but back in 1996, that was like, what is this witchcraft? And it's fully interactive. And it was fantastic. And even though now it's dated, because obviously everything was built in blocks and squares and cubes, you know, there was hardly any organic, even the Colosseum in this game is square. It's not a round Colosseum, it's just a square, it's a cube, which I always found funny. But yeah, I was introduced to this game, and in 1996, being heavily into, you know, Indiana Jones at this time when I was a kid, and then there's this game which is basically an Indiana Jones game but without Indiana Jones in it. You had the same action, you had an orchestral score, pretty much you had guns, animals and T-Rexes and zombies and gorillas to shoot while you were doing these puzzles. And you have all these major real archaeological sites throughout the world. You know, Pyramids of Giza, and you're in Greece, and you're in Atlantis and stuff like that. And it's just like, it spoke to me on a level, because it was basically, in my brain, it was an interactive Indiana Jones game, which had yet to come. I think Indiana Jones and the Emperor's Tomb was a few years after this. Was that 2003? 2002?
Yeah, sounds about right.
I loved Indiana Jones and the Emperor's Tomb, but this is kind of all we had. And then you had the opening cinematics, and you're like, what is this? Like, what is this game? And you literally, I was just, as a kid, I was just fully involved in the game. And it was just great. I just really enjoyed it. And puzzle solving, and you had, you know, silly things like swimming underwater. You run out of breath. Yes, we'd had that in like things like Sonic games and Mario games, but this is like a full 3D environment, and it's just kind of like a bit mind-blowing in a way, especially on a PC screen as well. So you're sitting closer to it than you would for like a console game, for instance. I just loved it. The whole story, it was a very convoluted plot like most things, but it just, you had all the key elements there to grab people that are interested in history, puzzles, Indiana Jones. You had it all there. You even had a boulder chase you two or three times throughout the game. You know what I mean? They knew what they were doing. You had to run away from arrows that were firing either side of you. So, but it was the finding the secrets, finding the treasure hunt and stuff. The little There were called secrets, weren't they, in the first Tomb Raider?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, where they're hidden on like ledges and stuff. And but a whole puzzle solving where you've got to find, I think, 5 cogs to turn a machine on to open the floodgates to raise the water to then backtrack where you were going. And I was watching a very interesting video on YouTube last week. And it's about someone had taken the game levels and extrapolated them and was breaking down the Tomb Raider level designs. We look at them from the top down and off graphic, they're really simplistic, but they do what they need to do. They take you where you need to go, and you've even got alternate routes where you can go and find treasures and through different passages or through different doorways and stuff, and you ultimately end up at the place you need to be. But it was the whole puzzle-solving thing. I don't think I'd ever done a game like that where you could turn the character around and the camera would turn around the whole environment. You could see everything.
Yeah.
And I remember having a Tomb Raider level guide as well, so I had a full walkthrough. So this is like, you know, back in the day, kids, this is how we used to find stuff. But it was just a fun game. And Uncharted would follow a few years later. And Uncharted, again, is one of my favourite game series because it encapsulates everything that was great about Indiana Jones and Tomb Raider, but in a whole new way of experiencing it, where they take the films and put them into a video game, and the Uncharted games are so cinematic. They're fantastic. And you've been replaying them, haven't you, Rich? Have you got around to it yet?
Yeah, I've actually started now on my PS3. So it's been the first time, so I'm quite excited. So about time.
When they did Uncharted, it was like Tomb Raider, but it was like slightly better and enjoyable. But I think that was only from a cinematic point of view, fully immersive. But yeah, as for Tomb Raider, it was one of those things that as soon as I was introduced to it at a friend's house on the PC, they lent it to me and my brother. And then I think I saved up for, 6 months to a whole year, like birthdays and Christmases and stuff like that, to get my own copy because it was just great. And then Tomb Raider 2 comes along and it's just like, blows it out of the water completely. And in the unlimited weapons and the double Uzis and the shotguns and stuff like that. And before Lara Croft was a mass murdering psychopath, she only killed a few animals and, you know, demons.
Yeah, but I think that was one of my favourite parts of the game was where you mentioned the exploration and the free-flowing nature of it. It was the combat as well, being able to run and shoot and two jump. Guns at the same time, all at the same time, and you're trying to shoot a tiger or something.
But the beauty of it was you didn't have to worry about aiming because the auto-aim would lock on.
Yeah.
The only trouble is the auto-aim, it wouldn't cycle through the different targets. So if you've got, say, 3 tigers or wolves in your area, your guns are only aimed on one until that's dead.
Mm-hmm.
So the others can still attack you. But yeah, it's that whole I'm running or strafing backwards while firing these two guns. It was just that. It was just like I'd never seen it before. And then you could also cycle through the guns really quickly. Next thing you know, you have a shotgun. And then you're shooting a T-Rex. And it's just nuts. But I think it just spoke to me. I was at that perfect age, that, you know, 12, nearly 13-year-old. And you get shown this game, like, this is everything. It's like,
I mean, it was pretty cool as well, where it was a female lead character as well, you know. Even now, they're definitely more of them, and that's a great thing to see. But back in 1996, I mean, it was still very much video games was a man thing. Yeah. You know, girls didn't play video games. That was shared by, you know, that thought was shared by quite a few people. And to see a female lead character in a big, massive game like this was really refreshing. And obviously that probably helped a little bit with a teenage boy brains.
Maybe. Exactly, yeah.
And the fact she properly transcended gaming as well, as she became like an actual pop culture icon. You know, she was on like, you know, your Lucas A bottles. She was on, was it FHM or Maxim magazine? I can't remember which one.
Yeah.
It's just like, that's crazy at the time. Again, and also, it's like the Wipeout thing again. It's like, oh, it's gaming, but this is different. This is growing up.
It was crazy because like, it just was like the Mario and Sonic craze, wasn't it? It just literally blew up 1 year.
Yeah.
And you got like famous models dressing up and going to these conventions. Mm-hmm. And you're like, what is going on? This is just a small indie game that I think was originally developed with, what is it, 6 people? this massive craze. Like you said, you know, you couldn't go to HMV or Electronics Boutique or whatever without seeing a poster or an action figure or a statue or T-shirts. Literally everything.
I mean, all that kind of thing you guys have said about the game, I think one thing that really stood out for me with Tomb Raider when I first played it was no game up until that point. In some ways, some games even today, like nothing's equaled that actual genuine feeling of like isolation. And
yeah, I was going to bring that exact point up.
Even though it was like completely isolated and you're on your own, the world you're in felt real and kind of lived. It sounds funny saying lived in, because I know it's not. It's a network of caves and temples, but it didn't feel like a level. It felt like I was really in this location and I was just moving through it. And I felt vulnerable. And it's one of those games, I think, is when nothing was happening. I found it unnerving and I found it very lonely. And
it was genius because intentional or not, it made you, like you said, your instinctive fears are, you're in this game. There's no ambience music until you discover a treasure or until you come across a point of interest or you get the action music come up where you get the bad guys turn up, you know.
Ugh.
But you're... Yeah. Your isolation is so deathly quiet, other than your footsteps.
Yeah. Yeah.
And like bird song or whatever.
And stuff, that's about it.
Yeah. And it reminds you that you are in the arse end of nowhere where no one knows where you are. And you actually felt that on the screen while you're playing it, especially through headphones.
Yeah.
It was even worse because you don't have the ambient stuff around you. You just got this full immersion going on. And you kind of don't get that with the reboot Tomb Raiders.
Yeah, especially the later on ones, like the Shadow of the Tomb Raider was just like, what are we doing? You've got this group of people around you, you've got walkie-talkies, I'm like, whoa, what's going on? No.
Yeah,
you're doing it wrong.
You missed that solitude.
Yeah.
And I've not played the third game in the series of the reboots either. Played the first two.
Not great.
But it was something missing where you rely so much on an ensemble. And that's why I kind of like the Uncharted games as well, because you have contact with your team, but very minimal.
Mm-hmm.
You are pretty much on your own for most of the game, apart from a few set pieces. But yeah, the isolation, especially Tomb Raider 2. I remember vividly playing Tomb Raider 2, where it opens at the Great Wall of China.
Mm-hmm.
And you're underneath the Great Wall. And there is nothing, and you can just hear the wind blowing through.
Nice.
Yeah, they just kind of add a few more things, but the isolation is just... It's like... reminds me of Doom.
Yes.
Where you're literally... You're on your own, and you don't know what's around any corner.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
It was just a puzzle solving, and then you do the whole puzzle, and then you realise, I've got it wrong, and then you've got to redo it all, because it all collapses, or it all resets itself. And it's like, oh, but yeah, I really enjoyed the game, and I'm glad my friend introduced me to it all those years ago, because it's been a fan favourite ever since. But all the Tomb Raider games that came afterwards, after Tomb Raider 3, I just never spoke to me as much as the first three did.
No, I totally understand that.
Really didn't. There was one of them where it was just so clunky, and it's just like, oh, I think I got through the second level, and then I've never played it since. It was on the 360, I believe.
The trouble with the Tomb Raider games was they tried to push out too many, I think they started getting to a year every year, didn't they?
Mm.
Or something. Yeah. I think they just tried to push them out, and they were just rushing them. And they weren't really making sure that they were good. They just wanted to get them out because they were a new Tomb Raider game and they just wanted to make the money from it.
Mm.
I don't know. It just spoilt the license, the games really a little bit because they tried that, unfortunately. But
I like the fact that they created an empowered female character, because young girls even gravitated towards the game.
Yeah.
And like we were saying earlier before we went on that little tangent, it's lovely to see that happen.
I think
it could have gone a completely different way, because I think the original design for the character was a guy with a hat.
Yeah.
And a gun holster. And I think early on in the development, I remember them, I think there's a documentary about Tomb Raider for about 10 years ago. And they've said, oh, hang on a minute, guys, we need to stop here. This is resembling something that we could get done by copyright theft. So then it became a completely different character. But I think it was a turning point, especially because it appealed to men and women. It was one of those first games that really blew up for both sides you know, don't misquote me on this, but like Jason said before then, I don't think there's many female empowered characters. Was Perfect Dark out by this point?
Oh no, that would have been...
That was a few years later, wasn't it?
Been about 98, maybe even near 99, I think.
Yeah.
What about you, Rich? Well, I mean, what is Tomb Raider for you?
I mean, yeah, really very much a lot of what Chris has said. And again, for me, the biggest thing was that feeling of isolation. It was the first time I felt alone and vulnerable in a game. It felt real instead of like, you know, this larger life character you're running through what is a traditionally structured level. I'm playing as this very real human being and it's very, what it seems a very real situation, you know. Yeah, it gets a little bit more fantastical as things go on, but early on when you're just trapped inside this cave and you're just moving your way through, trying to find a way back out, it's just, it feels like something that, you know, through a series of unfortunate events, it's like it could actually happen to you.
Sounds like my 2021, that does.
Yeah. And it just felt, that's what stood out to me. It was... And again, I mean, I got this the same year I got Wipeout. I was very much high on PlayStation, so it probably amplified the feeling for me of that I got from this game. But yeah, I just was sold on just this feeling it created, that feeling it evoked to me that hadn't been achieved by another game at that point. Again, Lara Croft is another character of her. It was refreshing. It was different. We all had our feelings towards her at that time of our lives.
Yeah.
In school, being horned up. And
it was always one of that episode of Spaced where where Tim's just drowning Lara for no reason, but just because he wants to drown things.
Yeah. That was one of the most horrible drowning animations as well, when she's like clutching her throat.
And it just keeps just cutting kind of to this animation and just cutting and cutting, all of a sudden she's...
Yeah, I mean, I will admit, there's a few times I chucked her off like a high ledge, and when she starts screaming,
curiosity,
it just breaks her neck and her legs, and legs, and it's like, ugh.
That lovely wet crunch. And then it lingers. It's that awkward, like 2 second linger. It's like, just cut the scene. Just cut the scene. You're still on this mangled body.
Yeah,
I think there's some like cool little ragdoll physics on that as well, because just literally just hits a deck and just kind of crumples
up. She eats it hard. So.
Yeah.
While we're on the subject of Tomb Raider, like, obviously it got to a point where they decided to create films for the series. I mean, what's your opinions on those?
The Angelina Jolie one is a guilty pleasure of mine. I don't know why. I think it was because I was still hot on the whole Tomb Raider 2 and 3 kind of train at that point. Angelina Jolie was a bums on seats guarantee, wasn't she? And you just like, I thought she did a good job. We had Chris Barry in there as the butler. We're like, what is going on? What the hell?
You just wanted to shut room. You always want to shut room inside the fridge. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. It was just like, that's Chris Barry, but going under the name of Christopher Barry in a massive motion picture. But those two films, I think, are really good. I really enjoyed them both.
Yeah, I don't remember anything about the second one, really, but yeah, I did enjoy the first one, very much like Chris, guilty pleasure. It wasn't one of those things I'd watched it thinking it was naff. I did get some actual genuine, unironic enjoyment out of it.
Yeah,
it was very much a 2002 film.
Yeah, it's the most 2001 2 film I've ever seen in my life. But you got
U2 song, U2 Elevation, that music video. I just this is awesome.
Yeah, ropey 2000 CG, but amazing stunts and set pieces and stuff, especially that shootout at Croft Manor where she's running on cables around the balcony. Yeah.
Absolutely.
The Alicia Vikander one I've watched once.
Yeah, it's fine.
And I don't think I've watched it again because I had so many good memories of the Tomb Raider on the 360, which I think I had that excitement for when me, you and Ian went to Eurogamer, Rich.
Yes.
And that was the unveiling of the Tomb Raider reboot.
Yeah, which was amazing.
And it was stunning. They had it on these, like, you know, like 78-inch TV screens, ultra HD, and it's like, that looks amazing. I think they had all the elements from the reboot in the film. Mm-hmm. But I think because I was so familiar with the game 1 and 2 of that reboot series, I kind of wasn't excited because I knew exactly what was going to happen.
It is very...
In a roundabout way.
It is very much like the Silent Hill film, which I do like, but it's very kind of by numbers. It just walks you through the game. And it's
let's just literally transfer the game to the screen.
Yeah. And so, yeah, you do go in thinking, okay, I know what's next. It's a bit weird.
Like when the trailer broke, I remember you messaging me saying, like, oh, the Tomb Raider trailer's out, and you were like, they've got the Endurance in there as well. And I was like, what?
Yeah.
I don't think they'll make a second one anytime soon of that one, but...
I heard they were. I heard, who's directing it now? I thought it was,
Was it actually happening?
Oh, God. I thought David Fincher's directing it.
I didn't know it was actually happening.
David Fincher.
David Fincher.
I'm not making it up. Trust me.
It's like when they were saying about Quentin Tarantino doing a Star Trek film.
Oh, God. That was never going to happen. Ever.
David Fincher. I'd like to see this version of Tomb Raider. It sounds amazing. Okay.
David Fincher's Tomb Raider.
The concept for Tomb Raider originated in 1994 at Core Design, a British game development studio. One of the people involved in its creation was Toby Gard, who was mostly responsible for creating the character of Lara Croft. Gard originally envisioned the character as a man. Company co-founder Jeremy Heath Smith was worried the character would be seen as a derivative of Indiana Jones, so Gard changed the character's gender. Her design underwent multiple revisions and redrafts during early development. The game proved an unexpected commercial success, reversing... I never know how to pronounce this game company's name. Like, is it Eidos?
Eidos?
It's Eidos, I think.
Eidos.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'll go with Eidos then. Eidos then bleak financial situation. After the success of Tomb Raider, work began on a sequel. Gard was no longer given full creative control, and it was stated by development staff that he was both saddened and disappointed by the use of Lara Croft's sex appeal in marketing. Gard left Core Design in 1997 to found his own gaming company, Confounding Factor, and was replaced by Stuart Atkinson. Tomb Raider 2 proved a larger commercial success than the original. Over the next 3 years, Core Design was committed to delivering a Tomb Raider game annually, putting considerable strain on staff. For this reason, and the feeling that they had exhausted the series' potential, the developers tried to kill the character off. This did not work, and while a fifth game was created, the team stated that they were not fully invested in its development. So yeah, quite interesting. And I think there's a lot more to the history of the Tomb Raider franchise in general, and there's a book that's recently been released, I think, that would really... goes into the making of Tomb Raider and its history and development, all that kind of stuff, written by a guy called Daryl Baxter, which you can get his book on Amazon right now for about £18. It's in my wish list, and it will soon be mine. Great pick as always, Chris. Thank you very much for that, Tomb Raider. All that's left is my pick for the video game tonight, 6, and obviously my pick is Quake. There would be a plot, really, because it's just when you first see Quake, it just looks like a first person shooter, just shoot everything you see and get to the end of the level, and that basically it kind of is. But I did appreciate the work that they put into the lore of the game and the plot of that. And in the single player game, the player takes the role of an unnamed protagonist named Ranger, who in later games is voiced by Trent Reznor. I don't know who Trent Reznor is, but it's important enough to be mentioned in here.
He's the guy from Nine Inch Nails. So.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Really? And
a singer.
Yeah. And obviously, Nine Inch Nails had a lot to do with the soundtrack to Quake. And playing it recently on the Switch, I noticed like all the ammo for the nail gun had the Nine Inch Nails logo on it.
Oh my god.
Yeah. which I had never obviously appreciated back when I played this originally. But yeah, so Ranger, he's sent into a portal in order to stop an enemy codenamed Quake. The government had been experimenting with teleportation technology and developed a working prototype called Slipgate. The mysterious Quake comprised the Slipgate by connecting it with its own teleportation system, using it to send death squads to the human dimension in order to test the martial capabilities of humanity. Before I carry on, I mean, I'm quite intrigued to know if you two have ever played Quake.
Played it, but I will confess I never really gave it much time, not compared to your Dooms and your Half-Lifes. And I feel like Quake and Unreal, both of them are ones I've just never given the time to that I should. I don't know. Yeah. I did every other like FPS franchise around that time, but I overlooked these. So yeah.
I played it around a friend's house maybe once, but not enough to actually get my interest in it and to go and pick it up. And again, 20 years later, you think, oh, I've never played them. Yeah. Not properly.
Yeah, and I think maybe I might have been the same, but with my elder brother, he had a PC that could play these kind of games, whereas my one didn't. I mean, my one was like a tiny computer with, I don't know, 6 gig hard drive. And no, I don't even think they did gigs.
That's generous. Jesus.
Yeah, I know, right? I think it must have been like a 500 meg hard drive or something with 4 megabytes of RAM. Me trying to put Quake on that, I think it would have just laughed at me. But he had the PC, had the capabilities of running Quake. So when we used to go and visit him around his house, that would be the game that I would sit down and play on his PC. And as Chris had mentioned earlier about 96 kind of being the year that we're getting into PC gaming, like it was really becoming quite a forefront of video games to play these kind of games on a PC. And this was one of my first experiences of that, and it was just amazing. And also this being like the successor to Doom, and to see what they've achieved from going from Doom to this was incredible. With all the 3D rendering, yet again with what you mentioned with Tomb Raider, I really appreciate the soundtrack, because it's the same kind of thing. They really tried hard to create an atmosphere with the soundtrack instead of just putting like loud rock music over the top of you running around gunning all these demons and such, you know. Yeah. That with all the different noises and industrialness of it all, it just really helped create this kind of weird atmosphere that I only experienced when I played this game. And like, even the things of like the grenades, when the grenades were fired and they hit the floor, it just had this weird sound that I'd never heard before. And even when I go back and play it on the Switch now, hearing that sound just takes me straight back to this point in my life, rekindling this atmosphere that I experienced when I played this game. Even now, I really appreciate what they tried to do with Quake, and watching the guys with the chainsaw, for instance, the animation, I really appreciate it. Like, you could see you'd fired your weapon, your shotgun or whatever at this enemy, and it knocked him over. And you could see him put his hand on the floor and push himself back up.
That's pretty cool.
To get back onto his feet so he could get ready to defend himself again. And yeah, for a game of 1996, I thought that was incredible.
Absolutely.
I think one of the other things I really loved about Quake was the quick load and the quick save. I never had this before. It was like, he said to me, like, if you just need to load, save your game, you just hit F5 and then that's it.
That's one of the first times then that was a thing, because I don't remember now when the first time I had quick save in a game, but geez.
That was incredible for me, you know, like with console gaming, it was, you had to hit checkpoints or certain points in the game for it to save, or you had to reach the end of the level before it would save again. To be able to just save the game from whatever point of the game that you were in, it was just incredible to me. Yeah. And still something I label with Quake all the time, obviously, as it was the first time I experienced it. And the quick load, quick save and the quick load, it was just life-changing, and it was hard to go back to when I play console games. I can't really think much more else to say about Quake. It's it's still a great game. It's still fun. I still think I like the. It still brings over the stuff from Doom, where you're not quite sure what's around the corner. I really enjoy kind of just this exploration of these environments and not quite knowing what's around the corner, and then going around that corner and then seeing what you see and going, oh shit, because you're just.
It was one of the first ones you could look up and down in that, wasn't it? Obviously, it was very much like Doom, but it gave you that more field of vision and, you know,
ability
to actually observe your surroundings.
There was moments in the game as well where the developers just fucked with you, because like you would go into what looked like a lift and then there was a button on the wall, so you would shoot it and then the ceiling would start coming down.
Sod that.
And then the door that you come in, it had shut, so you couldn't get out. And so you're thinking, oh shit, what the fuck have I just done? You know, the ceiling keeps coming down and down and down, and there doesn't seem to be any way of getting out of this situation apart from death. Just when the roof looks like it's about to hit you and starts, you know, squashing you, it stops, and then it kind of just opens up in half. And then the lift starts going up. So in fact, you were right all along. This was the way you were supposed to go, but the developers were just fucking with you. And it's like, you bastards. I fell for it even this week playing it. I still fell for that. But yeah, as I mentioned with the Nine Inch Nails as well, using like ambient soundscapes and synthesized drones to create the tracks. In an interview, there you go, there's Reznor, remarked that the Quake soundtrack is not music, it's textures and ambiences and whirling machine noises and stuff. We tried to make the most sinister, depressive, scary, frightening kind of thing. It's been a lot of fun. The game includes a homage to Reznor in the form of the ammo boxes for the nail gun and the Super Nail Gun decorated with the Nine Inch Nails logo. Some digital re-releases of the game lack the CD soundtrack that came with the original shareware release, but the 2021 remastered version does include the soundtrack. That's Quake, really. Just an amazing game, and they definitely built upon it for Quake 2. I remember playing that with just as much fun. And even Quake 3 to an extent. Obviously, they changed Quake 3 a lot. And it was just like a multiplayer game with the success of Unreal Tournament. They really wanted to capitalize on that and create their own version of it, using Quake and the Quake engine. And I do remember playing that quite a lot as well, and it being a lot of fun. But obviously, it being just a multiplayer game, it wasn't the same. No. And I still kind of yearned for the more traditional Quake experience. And even now, to this day, we're still waiting. And I think they are in some form of development of a Quake 4.
Really? Okay, I didn't realize.
I think so, off the top of my head. I remember reading something about it the other day. I don't know if it's actually true or not. It's a shame to see the series not progress, you know, and with the success of the Doom revitalization with Doom 2016 and Doom Eternal, and there's definitely a market for a new Quake game, definitely.
Oh, yeah, without a doubt. Yeah, I mean, I think the one I've dabbled with most was Quake 3 Arena on the Dreamcast. Mm-hmm. So it's probably the only time I've done it, which was fun. But yeah, that's all I can really speak of from experience. So,
some other tidbits I found on Wikipedia about Quake was about the lead designer and director, John Romero, who later conceived of Quake as an action game taking place in a fully 3D world inspired by Sega AM2's 3D fighting game Virtual Fighter.
Okay.
Quake was also intended to feature Virtual Fighter-influenced third-person melee combat.
Weird.
ID Software considered it to be risky because the project was taking too long. The third-person melee was eventually dropped. This led to creative differences between Romero and ID Software. I say I always pronounce it ID. And I know it's id, isn't it?
Is id, yeah.
Yeah.
So, it took me a long time to realise that as well. I did say ID. Until probably like last year or the year before when Microsoft acquired them. I didn't realise. So
I still always to this day call it ID Software. And I know it's id. I do apologise, but that's just me and my oldness. But eventually his departure from the company after Quake was released. Even though he led the project, Romero did not receive any money for Quake. In 2000, he released Dal Katana, the game he envisioned Quake being. And despite its shaky development and being considered one of the worst games of all time, he said it was more fun to make than Quake due to the lack of creative differences. It sounds like you have more experience with that game than you do with Quake, Rich.
I just remember all the fallout when that game came out. Everyone was hyping up so much, and it just was a bit pony. I did remember playing like a demo of it on PC, I think. Mm-hmm. I did the N64 version as well, which is like just a bad idea to begin with. Even if the game was good, probably a bad idea to begin with.
Yeah.
But yeah, I just remember it wasn't quite on the level of like Duke Nukem Forever, but it was close in terms of just the disappointment and the hype and the length of time it was in development. So
it kind of sounds like that Romero proved id Software right in not incorporating the 3D fighting into Quake.
Yeah.
It didn't work.
I'd say so, yeah.
Yeah, if anyone has any memories of these games that we've mentioned tonight, then please let us know over on the socials or give us an email or the links in our link in the show notes. It'd be great to hear your memories of them, all your experiences, and see if they match up with any of ours. Yeah, I think that's your lot for this one. We've successfully managed to do a podcast even through all the woes and technical issues that have been thrown our way for this one. So it's an achievement in on itself. Well done, lads.
Thank you.
We got it.
Our pleasure.
When my audio went, I was half expecting, I was like, all right, I'll just type everything up on the chat. And I was like, it's not going to be any help to anyone, is it?
Well, that would have made for an excellent, interesting podcast where me and Rich would have to pretend to be you.
Just read off my notes.
Can you do a good impression of Chris Rich?
I'm afraid not, no. Sorry.
Okay. Well, as I say, that's your lot for this one. Thank you for listening. Thank you for joining. And if you'd like to support us, then please consider joining the Wolfie Club, our version of the fan clubs we all joined as a kid. Badges, stickers, and even a membership card can be yours if you join a monthly membership, starting from just £1, or you can just give us a one-off donation to the show. If that's not your thing, head on over to buymeacoffee.com, the Wolfie Pod, to see all the options. And a big thank you to our amazing supporters, Andrew and Tristan. And if any of that is not right for you right now, you can also support us by just giving us a review or rating on Apple, Spotify, or Podchaser. Don't forget, as always, you can hear me and Rich talk video games with Andrew and Steve on the Dreamcasters podcast. We do promise there will be a new one coming out this year at some point. And I can also be found over at the Cross Players. Rich is also a member of the Dreamcast Junkyard team, and you can hear him waffle about the Dreamcast over on their DreamPod. You can find all these podcasts on Twitter at the Dreamcast Years, at the Cross Players, and at the DC Junkyard. As I mentioned, you will also find a link in the show notes which contains all our links, including our website, Twitter handles, and more. Next time, it's the big one, guys. It's Independence Day.
Ooh.
Looking forward to this?
Very much so.
Mm-hmm.
Very much so.
Mm-hmm. We might even try and get a guest on to join us for that one. So look,
Will Smith, Bill Pullman.
Yeah, mate, both of them. Easy. Only £50 each. Bargain.
Just have them on via cameo. Just... Yeah. That's what we should do. We should get them to do a cameo video. Talk about Independence Day. You have 2 minutes and 30 seconds.
That's not a bad idea. Although I'm sure even a cameo is probably still about £200.
That would be ridiculous. Those,
yeah. Wouldn't it? Yeah.
Well, not from Bill Pullman. Maybe from Will Smith.
Maybe.
That was harsh.
Maybe.
I'm sorry, Bill Pullman, if you're listening, which I doubt.
Boo. Boo, Chris. Boo.
I'd go for Harvey Fierstein, but I don't know if it's going to be a good audio. So I thought he was dead, but I thought he's still alive. Oh, he's dead. Oh, shit. Is he dead? No, he's not dead. Okay.
Good. Whew. Yeah. To be fair, though, I think like Randy Quaid would be the top one, wouldn't it?
Oh, Cousin Eddie. I'm back.
Well, look forward to this one in a couple of weeks' time, guys. As I say, thank you very much for joining us. My name's been Jason, and you've been listening to What's Wrong With Wolfie, a 90s podcast to the max. We'll catch you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye.
now? What's wrong with Wolfie? I can hear him barking.